Now, shall we begin?
Filed the original motion in limine, there was a part at the end, I think, of the memorandum where I was talking about the relevancy of statements by police, specifically in this case, the police officer, Richard Brockbank. He had made statements in an earlier hearing about how he interpreted the Facebook comments and how he interpreted it as a threat. And I think ultimately it's irrelevant for the purposes of this crime, whether or not he interpreted it that way. And would also add that I think it's conclusory for a witness to make that type of a statement on the stand. I think it's in the province of the jury to decide whether or not something is or isn't a threat. And specifically in this case, the jury needs to decide for themselves whether they feel there was a threat actually being made. So I'd like to have the court give a ruling on whether or not the officers should be allowed to testify to that effect.
I actually did make a 401 ruling. Something is relevant under 401 if it has a tendency to make the existence of a fact that is of consequence to the determination more probable or less probable. Officer Brockbank's testimony is relevant. While there is a proposed instruction by the state that is a tailored instruction related to State versus Anderson and State versus Mercer, where it says it is not necessary for the state to prove that the defendant's actions had an actual effect on the witness's testimony or that the defendant's actions prevented the witness from testifying, I find that testimony does have a tendency to make the existence of a fact that is of consequence to the determination more probable or less probable. So to that extent, based on what was before me and those matters that were filed, I do find the information is relevant. Under 403, I don't find that it's unduly prejudicial. And so I will permit the testimony.
Under what we are required to pretend is the law, a police officer who kills an innocent person cannot be held legally liable for that homicide if he insists in all apparent sincerity that he truly believed that that person threatened his life or his safety or posed some generalized threat to the unspecified public. This is the so-called reasonable officer standard for the use of force. Not surprisingly, the utterly perverse prosecution of Matthew Townsend, the Meridian, Idaho resident who faces 5 years in prison for witness intimidation on account of an innocuous Facebook post he had written, challenging the police officer who had arrested him without cause to testify truthfully. That case is being used to expand the so-called reasonable officer standard to include so-called acts of intimidating a police officer. In this case, Corporal Richard Brockbank of the Meridian Police Department, the only witness in the trial of Matthew Townsend for resisting and obstructing an arrest that had no moral or legal justification. Townsend's Facebook post, as I pointed out at length last week, was not an effort to dissuade or deter or intimidate Richard Brockbank from testifying. But to the extent that it involved Brockbank's testimony at all, and testimony was not mentioned in that Facebook post, to the extent that post dealt with the question of testimony, Townsend was urging, albeit implicitly, Brockbank to testify truthfully in the idealistic and misguided expectation that he would do so and that that would result in the dismissal of the charge against Townsend. That was Townsend's clear expectation. He was not trying to avoid his day in court. He was looking forward to his day in court. He was somewhat unreasonably optimistic that Brockbank would testify truthfully rather than test a lying, which of course is an occupational skill inculcated in police officers. Significantly, when he showed up for that hearing the next day and the Ada County Prosecutor's Office claimed that he had threatened a witness, the judge sitting in the hearing, James Cawthon, ruled that the Facebook post was not a threat. There's another really interesting question here that I don't think anybody else has addressed. Why would he show up at a hearing if he had intended to intimidate the witness away from appearing? Part of the strategy of the Meridian Prosecutor's Office in the Matthew Townsend case is contained in a jury instruction that they want Judge Lynn Norton to deliver at the end of the evidence that would say the following: it is not necessary for the state to prove that the defendant's actions had an actual effect on the witness's testimony, or that the defendant's actions prevented the witness from testifying. Among the citations provided in this request for a tailored jury instruction was State versus Anderson, a 2007 case involving a set of facts that are broadly similar to the Matthew Townsend case. The central holding of the State versus Anderson case was that Mr. Anderson could not be found guilty of witness intimidation unless the state could prove that he intended to prevent the witness from testifying. The question of whether the witness was actually prevented from testifying is peripheral to the central holding of the case. Mr. Anderson, a resident of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, was caught in flagrante with a girlfriend by his wife. There was an argument in which Mr. Anderson, who's a robustly unpleasant person, according to the facts contained in this appellate ruling, shoved his wife, thereby compounding his adultery with criminal battery. You don't commit adultery, and you certainly do not violently lay hands on your wife. He was arrested and briefly incarcerated, and after being released from the jail, rather than apologizing to his wife, which should have been the first thing he did, Anderson called the police officer who had arrested him, Officer Timothy Neal of the Coeur d'Alene Police Department, who at the time was away from his desk. Officer Neal later reported that Anderson's voicemail message said that if the case went to trial, that Anderson would, quote, get me on the stand and let people know I'm gay. I should point out that Anderson represented himself in court. On the assumption that making that claim in public would injure Officer Neal, he charged Anderson with felonious intimidation of a witness, which had the effect of making that claim part of the public record anyway. Anderson was convicted on charges of misdemeanor battery and felonious witness intimidation. He was sentenced to a year in prison and 2 years of supervised probation. He appealed his case to the Idaho Supreme Court, which overturned the felony conviction because of improper instructions to the jury. The trial judge had erred by failing to explain that the state had to prove every element of the offense, which includes not only the effort to intimidate or harass a witness, but the intention that the witness be prevented from testifying freely, fully, and truthfully in court. The jury may have concluded that Anderson did not leave the recorded message for the purpose of preventing Officer Neal from testifying freely, fully, and truthfully, but rather for the purpose of venting his anger or simply to irritate or annoy Officer Neal, according to the Idaho State Supreme Court. It is the state that bears the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that Anderson possessed the intent at issue. That's the key holding by the Idaho State Supreme Court in this case that was inappositely cited by the prosecution. They're using a peripheral element in an attempt to persuade the jury and to have the judge instruct the jury. The only thing that the state needs to prove is not that Matthew Townsend intended to threaten Brockbank or that he actually made a threat, but rather that Brockbank perceived a threat and that the fact that he perceived this threat is sufficient to justify convicting Matthew Townsend of witness intimidation. Honestly understood and honestly depicted, the ruling in State versus Anderson makes it clear beyond reasonable contradiction that Matthew Townsend did not commit that offense, because unlike John Anderson, Townsend never addressed Brockbank directly. Townsend did not threaten him with respect to his testimony. Anderson certainly did. Anderson made what has to be considered a threat, but the Supreme Court of the state of Idaho ruled that because the threat was not explicitly connected to a demand that the officer refrain from testifying fully, freely, and truthfully, that he couldn't be found guilty of witness intimidation. When I get back, I will go into greater detail regarding this studiously dishonest legal strategy being pursued by the thieves and liars at the Ada County District Attorney's Office. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio. Please stand by for more sedition after this.
Service on a jury affords you an opportunity to be part of the judicial process by which the legal affairs and liberties of your fellow men and women are determined and protected under our form of government. You are being asked to perform one of the highest duties of citizenship, That is, to sit in on judgment of facts which will determine the guilt or innocence of a person charged with a crime. You're instructed that you're not to discuss this case among yourselves or with anyone else, including any use of any emailing, text messaging, tweeting, blogging, electronic bulletin boards, or any other form of communication or electronic or otherwise during the recess. You're not to conduct any personal investigation or look up any information from any source, including the internet, and you're not to form any opinion as to the merits of this case until after it has been submitted to the jury for your determination.
Coeur d'Alene resident John Anderson was improperly convicted of witness intimidation, according to the Idaho State Supreme Court, because the trial judge did not correctly instruct the jury regarding every element of that offense. There are 9 elements of that offense. The crucial element is that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the intent existed on the part of the defendant to prevent a witness from testifying fully, freely, and truthfully. John Anderson had left a voicemail message on the answering machine of a police officer who had arrested him on a charge of domestic battery, threatening the police officer to the effect that if the officer appeared in court, that Anderson, acting as his own defense counsel, would get him to admit on the stand that he was gay. Anderson was arrested, charged with witness intimidation, convicted of misdemeanor domestic battery, which is an actual crime, and of felonious witness intimidation. The felony was overturned by the state Supreme Court for the following reason, and I quote, "The jury may have concluded that Anderson did not leave the recorded message for the purpose of preventing Officer Neal from testifying freely, fully, and truthfully, but rather for the purpose of venting his anger or simply to irritate or annoy Officer Neal. It is the state that bears the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that Anderson possessed the intent at issue, namely the intent to prevent Neal from testifying." What this means is that according to the state Supreme Court here in Idaho, you can, if you are a defendant in a criminal prosecution, harass or annoy a police officer who's going to testify against you, and that does not constitute witness intimidation. The Ada County District Attorney's Office cited this Supreme Court ruling, the state Supreme Court ruling, in their request, which is apparently going to be granted, that trial judge Lynn Norton instruct the jury that it is not necessary for the state to prove that Officer Richard Brockbank did not testify against Matthew Townsend. All they have to prove, supposedly, is that Richard Brockbank perceived Townsend's Facebook post as a threat. Not that it was an intentional threat, but that it was a perceived threat. They're studiously avoiding the most important element of that ruling. That shouldn't surprise us one bit. During the probable cause hearing in the Townsend case, which was held on April 15th of last year, Assistant Ada County Prosecutor Tanner Stellman repeatedly referred to what he called threats levied against the officer. Every time Aaron Tribble, Matthew Townsend's defense attorney, in his cross-examination of Officer Brockbank, asked him to explain why these comments were perceived as threats, Stellman objected, saying that these questions were not relevant. Brockbank was claiming that a threat had been made against him. The prosecutor had guided his testimony into putting on record the claim that threats had been made against him. And yet when Tribble tried to analyze the basis for the claim that these were threats, Stellman objected, and Judge Judy Gardunia agreed. She upheld every objection made by the prosecutor. In other words, the mere fact that he's asserting that these are threats, when they don't meet the legal definition of a true threat under Brandenburg, the Supreme Court decision, which is still the definitive case on the legal questions having to do with true threats, all that's necessary in order to define these as threats is an assertion by the supposed victim. Judge Judy Gardunia, not surprisingly, found probable cause to support the charge of witness intimidation, claiming that what Townsend wrote, quote, went well beyond just making a statement. During Brockbank's testimony and that of the deputy chief of police in Meridian, reference was made repeatedly to a case in Idaho Falls in which a police officer was supposedly the victim of retaliation by somebody whom he had arrested. That supposedly was in the mind of Richard Brockbank and his colleagues as they were examining a Facebook post in which Matthew Townsend didn't say anything that could be reasonably construed as a threat of violence, indeed in which he specifically and repeatedly eschewed any endorsement of violence of any kind or any unlawful activity. Notwithstanding the clear black-letter text of the only evidence at issue, what Brockbank and his deputy chief of police said in clearly coached and coordinated testimony was that they were burdened by the thought of this recent episode in Idaho Falls in which another police officer faced violent retaliation in the form of arson against his home. They're referring to an incident that occurred on December 15th of 2014 in which an Idaho Falls resident named Melvin Savage set fire to the home of attorney Lori Gaffney, who had represented Savage's ex-wife in a typically contentious and unpleasant divorce proceeding. As it happens, Gaffney's husband is Idaho Falls police officer Eric Anderson, who was not targeted in this criminal assault. Savage clearly nursed a grudge against Gaffney, but there's no evidence at all whatsoever that he was ever arrested by her husband. During the two-week period leading up to the arson, an unknown perpetrator believed to be Savage, but never proven to be Savage, repeatedly slashed the tires on Anderson's patrol car, which had been parked in the driveway of the couple's home. Savage was arrested, and he subsequently pleaded guilty to a charge of arson. He worked up to that offense after sending Gaffney a series of threatening emails, including one in which he promised to visit her office and sign the final divorce decree in blood. That was an overt threat of criminal violence, and the violent acts of property destruction of which he was eventually found guilty. This all stands in stark and striking contrast to Matthew Townsend's publicly announced intention to use peaceful and lawful means to protest what he believed to be an unlawful and vindictive arrest. There was nothing in the Facebook post that can be rationally construed as a threat of violence against anybody, especially in light of the fact, once again, that Matthew Townsend explicitly foreclosed the possibility of violence. But we've entered a realm in which police officers are triggered as if they were cringing campus feminists merely by being subjected to public criticism of their actions. That's the standard that is being created here in the Matthew Townsend prosecution. They're creating what could be called the officer safe space standard. As we've seen on countless occasions, the most important public policy consideration is officer safety, owing to the fact that the sanctified personages of the state's punitive priesthood are incomparably valuable. The officer safe space doctrine dictates that their fragile egos are to be subject to similar protection. I'll be back in just a minute.
Safe space.
People don't judge me and haters don't hate in my safe space.
Your safe space.
Bullyproof windows, troll safe doors, nothing but kindness in here.
You might call me a pussy, but I won't hear you in my safe space.
My safe space.
Bullyproof windows.
If you do not like
and you will see there's a very select crowd in your safe space.
My safe space. People that support me mixed in with more people that support me and say nice things. Rainbows all around me. There is no shame in my safe space.
My safe space.
Bulletproof windows.
going to tear down your safe space. Brick by brick, I shall smash it with glee.
What? Who is that?
You cannot stop me from getting inside. I am cold and I am hard, and my name is Reality.
The late Lieutenant Joseph Glinowitz, who was posthumously awarded his department's Medal of Honor and extolled as a hero and mentor to the police officers of tomorrow, was a morale-killing bully, habitual drunk, adulterer, and also had a nasty habit of sexually harassing fellow employees at the Fox Lake, Illinois Police Department, according to personnel records that were exhumed by the Chicago Tribune. 7 years ago, his fellow officers pleaded with the mayor to intervene when the police chief refused to fire Glinowitz, or at least hold him accountable for his behavior. Glinowitz's self-destructive behavior was widely known by his colleagues long before his September 6th suicide, which was a product of desperation over fear that his embezzlement from the local police explorers unit might be exposed. In his crowning act of self-aggrandizing cynicism, the uniformed crime lord staged his death in a fashion that he knew would resonate with the state-aligned media's prevailing war on police narrative. There is a reason why I'm reviewing this case, which resulted, by the way, just in the last couple of days, in the arrest of his widow, who had also been implicated in the embezzlement scandal. There's a reason why I'm discussing this that is directly relevant to the Matt Townsend case. In the aftermath of Glinowitz's death, the town of Fox Lake, Illinois, and the surrounding area were put under martial law. At least 4 schools were closed down, roadblocks and checkpoints were erected, snipers were deployed, and strike teams prowled through the city with utter indifference to property rights and due process. Door-to-door searches were carried out within a 2-mile perimeter near the location where Glinowitz was supposedly killed by 3 assailants. Helicopters and canine units were dispatched. Officials from several federal agencies, including the FBI, the Marshals Service, and the ATF, were enlisted in the effort. Local and national media, dutifully reciting official talking points, described the officer's death as an assassination carried out by dangerous fugitives who remained at large. The public was told that the 30-year veteran, known as G.I. Joe, was a clean-cut paladin of public order. Yet the local officers who participated in the search for his supposed killers knew that Glinowitz had long been a corrupt liability to the department that employed him and an active danger to the community he supposedly served. On many occasions, various members of the department have approached then-Police Chief Michael Behan with information and complaints about Lieutenant Glinowitz, wrote several members of the department in a 2009 letter to the mayor of Fox Lake. To date, members of the police department have been disappointed time and time again with Chief Behan's lack of action. Among the complaints listed in the letter were repeated suspensions for an inappropriate sexual relationship with a subordinate, sexual harassment and making threats to a dispatcher, and unauthorized removal of police reports from the police department. Personnel with the Fox Lake PD reported seeing him in bars during duty hours and had been informed by bouncers that he had been escorted from the establishment in a highly intoxicated condition. He also reportedly refused to pay a bar tab in excess of $300. Some of his colleagues had seen him with females other than his wife in circumstances that suggested ongoing extramarital affairs. The Chicago Tribune reports that the dispatcher who had been harassed by Glinowitz wrote a letter in 2003 accusing accusing him of threatening to put bullets in her chest and discard her body in a nearby lake. 2 days later, she wrote another letter to the chief saying that the officer had intimidated her by bringing a gun into her workplace. More recently, Glinowitz had been suspected of planning a contract hit on a county supervisor investigating his financial improprieties. Less than a week after Glinowitz's staged suicide, his memory was honored in the familiar Soviet-style ritual of official mourning, complete with serried rows of uniformed police officers from around the country and other trappings of a military funeral. The ceremony at Antioch Community High School included a performance of country artist Joe DiMassina's ballad, Heaven Was Needing a Hero. He was praised as a family man, a friend, a hard worker, and a youth mentor, as well as a dad to about 1,000 others through the Fox Lake Explorers Post 300, the program from which he was embezzling. One eulogist referred to him as a mentor to the police officers of tomorrow. At the time of his death, Glinowitz was known to be anything but a hero to many of the people who played an indispensable role in his final act of self-serving deception. As he pulled the trigger, Glinowitz may well have felt a certain grim satisfaction in the knowledge that the institutional priorities of the department that employed him would require it to become a party to his deceit. He also most likely anticipated how the media would depict his demise. This was slotted very comfortably in the prevailing narrative of the so-called war on police, despite the fact that last year, 2015, was a safer year for police officers measured in terms of on-duty violent death or injury than the year before. The reason I bring this up in connection with the Matthew Townsend case is an objection filed by the liar known as James Vogt, a deputy prosecuting attorney in Ada County, to a motion in limine that had been filed by Aaron Tribble, the defense attorney for Matthew Townsend. That motion in limine would have recognized that Townsend's Facebook post was a First Amendment-protected expression of his political opinions, rather than being evidence of a crime. Vogt's objection to the motion in limine filed by Aaron Tribble is one of the most tortured pieces of sophistry ever to assail my long-suffering eyes. Mr. Townsend's words are more threatening in an era where the police are under attack from civilians, battered and killed in the line of duty. Given the current political, cultural climate, Mr. Townsend's message that he knows where Brockbank and his family lives, that he is not afraid to come to their homes, and that the way to end the current situation is through violence serve as a real and true threat. Townsend's message said none of the things imputed to him in this lying motion. In his attempt to corroborate the claim that police officers face unprecedented risks that apparently require some modification to the First Amendment protections afforded to expression of political opinions, the liar James Vogt, in a footnote, referred to a handful of media accounts, arguing by anecdote rather than by reason, and the purpose of these anecdotes was not to inform, but to inflame. This, by its very nature, is prejudicial. The first is a headline from last September, Nampa police search for man accused of injuring officer. That story briefly described an incident in which an accused shoplifter struggled with the police officer, overwhelmed him, and then fled, and the police officer suffered minor injuries of the sort that occasionally occur when you're dealing with a violent criminal suspect. They occur much more commonly, by the way, when it is a private security officer involved in trying to protect property. Another footnote referred to a genuinely tragic incident with which we're all familiar, that occurred in Houston last year, in which a Harris County sheriff's deputy was murdered at a gas station by a man who walked up and shot him in the back of the head while he was filling up his patrol vehicle. Supposedly this was done because the deputy was wearing a police officer's uniform. What we later found out is that the assailant is a mentally ill man. We also found out that the deputy sheriff was not on duty at the time. He was headed to an assignation with his mistress. He wasn't killed because he was wearing a uniform. He was killed because he was someplace he shouldn't have been, on his way to do something that he should not have been doing. Once again, this has nothing to do with any climate of opinion that would supposedly justify abridgments of the First Amendment. The third story describes a police detective who was involved in an altercation at a parking lot in which a suspect allegedly grabbed his pistol and then struck him over the head repeatedly and then took off. His story isn't that he lost a fight, but rather that he was reluctant to use deadly force because of the climate of opinion. I have no way of knowing whether or not that's true. But the most important of the stories, cited by the liar James Vogt in his argument that the First Amendment doesn't protect criticism of the police, is the story of Lieutenant Joe Glinowitz. Joe Glinowitz, unlike Matthew Townsend, was a violent criminal. Joe Glinowitz, unlike Matthew Townsend, threatened people explicitly with acts of criminal violence. I seriously doubt that James Vogt actually knows any of the details of this story, or any of the other stories that he cited, in his effort to persuade the trial judge that the First Amendment doesn't protect Matthew Townsend. Vogt doesn't care. He's just spitting out words to watch them splatter in the serene confidence that the trial judge will do everything that she can in order to point the jury in the direction of conviction. I'll be back in just a minute.
Let's look at the numbers. In the year 2013, the numbers were surprisingly lower. There was about 27 police officers killed, one of the lowest rates ever. 2014 was about 51, and 2015 also looks fairly low, historically, at about 36. And those numbers can also be dissected when you look at those officers who might have been killed, for example, in automobile accidents. But we're talking about gun crime, the type of crime that we're talking about. Those numbers have gone down. Look at how it's been historically. In the 1970s, the numbers were 6 to 7 times higher. And during Prohibition years, it was 14 to 17 times higher.
Friends with, or your husband is a police officer. Do you think that would cause you to favor testimony of a police officer more than you would perhaps somebody else's testimony? Possibly. Okay. So you feel like in general there's a possibility that you would look more favorably upon testimony of an officer than you would on somebody else. Your Honor, I'd like to ask that number 4 be excused for cause.
Juror number 5, which law enforcement agency does your husband work with?
Ada County.
Are you making that statement about your husband, or are you making that statement about every law enforcement officer?
I know that there are bad law enforcement officers, but I would definitely take what they say into consideration because they have taken that oath, and I assume that oath taken multiple times. But they are supposed to be law-abiding officers.
So do you believe that you must believe everything an officer testifies to because they've taken a law enforcement oath?
Of course not. I like to look at the facts and see what has been said, and I like to see proof.
Do you believe that you can fairly evaluate the officers that testify in this case and make a decision based only on your evidence, on the evidence and testimony that's actually presented in this case?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you think that you would be a fair juror if you were called to sit as a juror in this case?
Yes.
Do you think that you would be an impartial juror if you were called?
Possibly.
Okay. What would prevent you from being impartial?
It's hard to explain just because I kind of know what goes on in law enforcement. Sometimes I know that things can be said, but like out of the heat of the anger and then try and take back. So it's just kind of like the whole care if you were taken like unjustly by, like, say you were arrested, like he was saying you thought you were innocent. I think that you would have to talk to your lawyer and get like help.
Based on those responses, I don't find an actual or implied bias. I'm not going to excuse her for cause.
We're a day after Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and he said, unjust law is no law at all. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes.
Yeah? How many of you would agree with that? Hold up the numbers. Everybody's there? Okay. So it'd be fair to say then that some of you feel that there are times where law can be unjust. Okay. I'm seeing a lot of nods.
Sustained. Let me go back and re-instruct the jury. As the judge in charge of this courtroom, it is my duty at various times during the course of this trial to instruct you as to the law that applies to this case. The duty of the jury is to determine the facts, to apply a law set forth in the instructions to those facts, and in this way decide the case. In applying the court's instructions as to the controlling law, you must follow those instructions regardless of your opinion of what the law is or what the law should be or what any lawyer may state the law to be.
It is presumed that juries are the best judges of facts. It is, on the other hand, presumed that courts are the best judges of law. But still, both objects are within your power of decision. You have a right to take it upon yourselves to judge of both and to determine the law as well as the fact in the controversy, explained Chief Justice John Jay of the United States Supreme Court in a 1794 jury trial in the case of the state of Georgia versus Brailsford. John Jay, I submit, knew a little bit more about the Constitution and the law than Judge Lynn Norton of the 4th District Court of the state of Idaho in Ada County. The audio excerpt at the beginning of the segment documents Judge Lynn Norton committing what could most charitably be described as judicial malpractice by misinforming the jury about the scope of their authority and the purpose of the jury itself. In the state of Idaho, as is too often the case throughout the Soyuz, judges are required to instruct the jurors that the jurors have no role in rendering a ruling on the merits of a law or with respect to the interpretation of the law. Their job is to apply the law as the judge defines it. In the case of Matthew Townsend, Judge Norton and Ada County Deputy Prosecutor James Vogt are deliberately fashioning and repurposing the law in a way that would ensure an unjust conviction. I believe that the intention here is that they would give Matthew Townsend, upon being convicted on the basis of an infirm or deliberately dishonest reading of the law, a prison sentence of 5 years with 1 year fixed, and that any appeal he would file would not be heard until after he had already served his sentence. At that point, the purpose of punishment would be achieved. As it's being defined here, the law is not going to withstand appellate scrutiny. But they want to extract their proverbial pound of flesh from this political dissident. And so, in order to do this, they're misinforming the jury about the case law and the precedents, as I have documented in this program and in last week's program. To give you some measure of the depth of dishonesty to which James Vogt has descended, I will read some further excerpts to the objection that he filed with respect to the motion in limine. Intimidation in the constitutionally prescribable sense of the word is a type of true threat where a speaker directs a threat to a person or group of persons with the intent of placing the victim in fear of bodily harm or death, wrote Mr. Vogt. In the instant case, Mr. Townsend's Facebook posting, taken as a whole, think of that for a second. As I pointed out last week in his opening statement, Vogt did not read the Facebook posting as a whole. He didn't read anything from that posting. He paraphrased it in the most dishonest imaginable fashion. Not a single phrase that was uttered by James Vogt as if he were quoting from that Facebook post was actually found in that Facebook post. Yet in this response to the motion in limine, he claims that the Facebook posting taken as a whole is proscribed by the witness intimidation statute and not protected by the First Amendment. Mr. Townsend threatened to invade Brock Banks' neighborhood. To invade. Once again, the purpose is to inflame, not to inform. What he said was that he would conduct peaceful, legal protests in the neighborhood of everybody associated with his prosecution. The list of options that Mr. Townsend left available to the state, that's the first honest thing that Vogt has actually written. The object of this petition was the state. The list of options that Mr. Townsend left available to the state included killing. That is to say, he recognized that the state reserves the supposed right to kill him. You cannot threaten somebody by recognizing that that person is threatening you. Once again, Mr. Townsend's post must be viewed in the light of recent events as well. His words are more threatening in an era where the police are under attack from civilians battered and killed in the line of duty. Given the current political cultural climate, Mr. Townsend's message that he knows where Brock Bank and his family lives, that's not what he wrote, that he is not afraid to come to their homes, that's not what he wrote, and that the way to end the current situation is through violence, that is a direct contradiction of what he wrote, serve as a real and true threat. This is not protected speech. This is not political protest. This is harassment to achieve an end, to prevent Brock Bank from testifying and to have his criminal case dismissed. And that, once again, is a direct lie. What Townsend wrote anticipated that there would be a judicial proceeding, that Brock Bank would testify truthfully, and that as a result of that truthful testimony, the case would be dismissed. Not content with bemirding the record with these feculent falsehoods, after Tribble filed a motion to dismiss the case, Vogt amplified his misreading of the law. The state incorporates by reference the arguments previously stated in its objection to the motion in limine, filed on September 2nd of 2015. It adds in support the holding in Virginia versus Black, from 2003. The court noted that conduct that may be protected as core political speech in one context may be constitutionally proscribable in the context of being used to unlawfully intimidate. While at issue in Black was whether cross-burning was protected under the First Amendment, the logic in that case applies to the instant case, meaning the supposed witness intimidation allegedly perpetrated by Townsend against Officer Brock Bank. Because Idaho's witness intimidation statute requires the specific intent that the statements be made with the intent to intimidate, the statute is not constitutionally overbroad. Last week I pointed out that the Ada County Prosecutor's Office would not issue an order of protection to a woman who is the mother of four, facing specific, repeated, explicit threats of lethal violence by a stalker because they supposedly didn't have the authority to protect this woman from the recidivist felon who eventually shot and nearly killed her. Within days of arresting Matthew Townsend in defiance of an existing court order on a felony charge of supposed witness intimidation, they did get an order of protection for Richard Brockbank. And here we have the Ada County Prosecutor's Office pretending that an unarmed, nonviolent civilian posting a message on Facebook that could be taken as an oblique exhortation to a witness to tell the truth is the equivalent of a Ku Klux Klan clavern burning a cross on the lawn of a terrified Black person in the South. Once again, the most charitable construction we can put on this is that these people are delusional. We're not dealing with mere delusion here. We're dealing with deeply entrenched depravity and dishonesty. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I'll be back with you again in a week. And until then, as always, doom spirto pugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.